Welcome to the Doggy Dojo. I'm your host, Susan Light, a Los Angeles-based dog trainer and behavior consultant on a quest to become worthy of the title Sensei of the Doggy Dojo. Today, we're talking about a complex topic, dog emotions. We're going to focus on some of the most commonly misunderstood emotions, and we'll answer the questions, do dogs feel guilt? And do dogs manipulate us? My guest is a veterinary behaviorist. She is the owner of Florida Veterinary Behavior Service, a specialty behavior practice in Southeast Florida, and co-owns Dog Nerds, an online educational resource for owners whose pets have behavior disorders. She's published research articles, co-authored multiple books, and served as an expert on numerous television programs. Please welcome Dr. Lisa Radasta. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you today about dogs, emotions, and guilt, and all the cool sciencey things that we can discuss regarding dog behavior.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting topic, and I think there's a lot of confusion about it. Because humanizing and anthropomorphizing animals, it's really kind of controversial. Like, some people think it's good to do that. Some people think it's not. So I guess my first question would be, like, we're going to talk a lot about, you know, the emotional life of dogs and how they're projecting it and how we're perceiving it. What evidence are we going to base your answers on? Like, what kind of evidence do we have that this isn't just your opinion on how dogs feel?
I think first of all, the topic that you brought up is really broad. So I can't even answer that question really based on how it was asked. So I'm just going to kind of twist it around a little bit and revamp it. So if the question is, do dogs have emotions, right? Then we're going to look at the evidence for how dogs communicate. We're going to look at any evidence that we can identify some sort of emotional state based on body language or vocalizations, right? So that would be going down that pathway. But then adjacent to that pathway is the pathway where we look at people's interpretations of animal emotional states based on their own biases, because there's research into that as well. Right. Oh, wow. And then we also can look at adjacent to that, or we can think of this kind of as a spider web with dog emotions kind of in the middle. Right. And then there's all of these potential topics we can discuss. We also can discuss how potentially, or what evidence we have or lack thereof, that dogs feel empathy, that they read us, how dogs may, in fact, adopt the emotional states of their pet parents. So this is like an 8-hour, you know, roundtable discussion. So we really don't have one answer, but I have opinions, of course. Anybody who follows me on social media knows I have lots of opinions. And then we have the science, and we just don't, in any part of behavior, I think, human or animal, probably, we don't have enough research to talk definitively as we would like about emotion, even in people. And it feels comforting to think we know it, like I know this. The reality is, anyone who's got one foot in science understands that even when we think we know it, we might not know it.
Yeah. And what we think we know changes the more research we do. Right?
That's right.
That's just the nature of science. I know that feels a little convoluted, but I'm glad that we sort of touched on that, because I feel like a lot of the Instagram, TikTok people are like, this is blah, 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 and they oversimplify it. So I think it's good to know where we're coming from as we go into this topic. So yes, obviously we don't have 8 hours, so we're gonna narrow it down. The one that I want to make sure that we talk about, and maybe we'll have time to talk about other emotions, is guilt, because I feel like there's so much misunderstanding around dogs feeling guilt and like they should know better and they know what they did was wrong and I came in and they have this look on their face and they feel guilty that they did it. And there's so many videos and my heart just goes out for these dogs. And I think at the root of it is just a basic misunderstanding on our part of what's going on there.
Yeah. And so going back to, so we have several studies that look at guilt. They were studies that were similar in their procedures, in that they basically used food and blinded, which means for people that don't follow science, when you say you're blinded, it means you don't know what's going on. You do not know the materials and methods involved in that study. You don't know the procedures, right? So in the studies that looked at guilt in dogs, the pet parent, and I'm going to refer to him as pet parent, and you know, that's controversial too, but yeah, the pet parents did not know whether or not their dog committed a crime. Let's put it that way. And the crime was eating food when the pet parent had instructed the dog not to eat the food. Okay. So basically, procedures varied somewhat, but basically the idea was food was put out. The dog was told not to take the food. And one way or another, the food disappeared. In one study, the researcher gave the dog the food. In another study, they picked it up. All right. So knowing that, pet parents walk back in and they are expected to tell the researcher whether or not their dog took the food, right?
Okay.
And yeah, so what we see in both of these studies, and again, the procedures were slightly different, is that pet parents are not able to accurately distinguish. So this is the Oystoik study, not able to accurately distinguish whether the dog took the food or not. So they are judging dog body language. They are saying, my dog took the food, right? The food's not there, and my dog looks guilty. He took the food. Whereas we would hope that people could read their own dog's body language well enough that they'd be able to say, hey, no, my dog doesn't look guilty. Even though the food isn't there, I know that my dog didn't take the food. So people are not able to distinguish. And in studies where the people come back into the room and are told, your dog took the food. So they scold their dog like, hey, no, don't do that. Or you shouldn't have done that. Or you're a bad dog. And the dog results with a guilty look. In those studies, what the researchers were measuring was, okay, we're telling you the dog took the food, but I picked the food up and I put it in my pocket. And you yelled at the dog and the dog looked guilty. So how close does the dog body language of guilt, this is our label of what the dog looks like, correlate with the dog's emotional state? We can't say, because dogs don't tell us their emotions, but how well does guilt correlate with a crime? That's really what these studies are asking. And the dog's guilty look, what we identify or label as guilt, did not correlate well in either study with the crime. Okay. So some dogs look guilty and they didn't commit a crime. People identified their dogs as guilty and the dogs never committed a crime. So what is happening there? What is guilt? What we're labeling as guilt, and I keep using label again and again because labels are helpful and dangerous. So what we're labeling as guilt is what we would probably say ethologically is deference. Is what we probably would have labeled a decade ago, if this term helps people, as submission. It's basically the look the dog gives when the body's lowered. Maybe they avert their gaze. They put their ears back. They may lower their head, right? A look of a little kid putting his head down when he's getting scolded. So we transfer that to dogs. We anthropomorphize and transfer it to dogs. We label it as guilt. And then we tell ourselves a story in our head that we believe to be true. Right? Because the dog looks like something I'm familiar with, a kid with his head down because I've scolded him. And he must be feeling, and this is the problem, he must be feeling the same as the kid is feeling. Then there's the big, so that's a huge leap. That's a gigantic leap, right?
And but I think we do that naturally. When you say that, yes. It's like, I think that's what we do. Yeah.
To not just with animal, not just with non-human animals. We do it with each other all the time, right? So then we tell ourselves this story, our dog is guilty. But here's the thing. Then our logical brain, which makes sense of all the inputs through the day, the smells and what we hear and see, it says to us, oh, right, well, you can only be guilty if you understand the crime and you understand that it was wrong. So you must understand it was wrong because I've labeled you as guilty because you look like my child when my child is guilty. Can you see how this is backwards and upside down? It's a mess. Yeah, it's a mess.
I do, but I will say that it was one of the just light bulb moments for me in my career, because I think as humans, like you said, in these studies, this is what we do automatically. We're putting everything on our human level and we're making these assumptions. But I think it comes down to this core idea that I think we'd love to get across to people today, is that our dogs are not moral creatures. When you say you have to know that it's wrong because I told you not to and you did it. That was wrong. That morality doesn't exist in the animal kingdom. It's a human construct.
Well, so morality, right? Oh, that's a big word. So, but then I can, let me separate that again, like to kind of parse it out and separate it into dogs who know they're wrong, because we do teach dogs things. We teach them to sit or lie down or do whatever, we wait for their food, like whatever we do, go get a ball and bring it back. So at what point does a dog know he's wrong? At what point does a dog or any animal know that the behavior that they were asked to perform, that they chose not to perform it, and that's incorrect? Because I think you're right. Wrong implies morality, whereas incorrect is just like you're taking a math test and you put 2 + 2 = 5. You're incorrect. So I'd like people to consider themselves teachers of their dog, right? Which is really what a parent is, I think. So I'm okay, again, with that pet parent term. But I know a lot of people aren't, okay, and that's fine too. So if they're instructors, if their dog was incorrect, did their dog make a choice to be incorrect? So when I talk to clients, this happens, I would say this happens very regularly, that a client will say that they know, usually the first appointment before we've had a chance to really educate people, where they know their dog is wrong. And I say, how did you know? Well, okay, he knows how to sit. And I say, I hear you. How do you know that he knows how to sit when you tell him? Well, because he does. Okay, I hear you. How do you know? Let's ask him right now. But when you ask him right now in my exam room, you can't move your hands and you can't reach for a treat. So did you train your dog with a voice cue or a hand signal? I use both. Okay. Well, I'm just telling you right now, I bet everything in my bank account, if you don't move your hand, your dog's not going to sit. Your dog doesn't know the cue when he's not looking at you, because you've moved your hand every time, which is totally fine, except you didn't have a correct expectation. So the person who's incorrect is not the dog. Your expectation of the dog is incorrect. You didn't train him to sit with a voice cue only and not a hand signal. So your dog only sits when you move your hand. So the day you asked him to sit and you were walking to the sliding glass door to go outside and he wasn't facing you, he didn't sit because he doesn't know it. So we have to really help people understand dogs aren't robots. I believe they have emotions, even though I can't prove it with science, right? However, we have to also remind them that dogs are only taught what we teach them as it relates to trained behaviors. And that if your teaching is a mess, your dog's not going to listen.
So true. I do a lot of tricks, and tricks makes you really see what your cue is. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it makes you have to, and people, I think, get less emotional about it if it's a trick that they're cueing instead of an obedience cue. Because if they're, it's like, oh, try to get them to roll over. And it's like, oh, they'll only do it in certain circumstances. It's easier to be like, well, that's their cue. You know, we can work on changing the cue, as opposed to people being like, well, they just don't want to do it because they don't respect me, or blah, blah, blah. This garbage that people tend to attach to a dog not, quote unquote, obeying them.
Yeah.
When they want them to do something or not do something.
Yeah. And, you know, this kind of makes me think of the, you know, anthropomorphizing animals, because I think there are positives and negatives to this. In one camp or in one bucket, there's the positives, because, you know, people talk a lot about millennials. everybody's interested in them, advertisers, social media, everybody's interested in millennials. But the thing about millennials is that if we can categorize a group of people, is that I think they're kind of the first group to really, really, really anthropomorphize. And what it has done, I think, for the good of animal welfare is that they really want to care for these animals emotionally as well as physically. You know, I'm an ex and I am closely bonded to my animals. So I'm, you know, doing the same thing millennials are, but my group of people that I grew up with loved their pets, but they weren't our babies. We had babies. And so I'm one of the ones who waited to have a baby. I waited till I was 37 and I really did live that life where my dogs, for all intents and purposes, were my kids. And I really believed it and felt it. And that allowed me to have a very strong bond. That allowed me to have empathy. That I see these pet parents coming in now and what they're writing on their questionnaire form under goal. And, you know, I only see dogs with behavior problems as a function of being a vet behaviorist, but under their goal, they write, for my dog to live a happier life. I would have never seen that a decade ago. And that is anthropomorphizing the pet. It's making that pet a child. So how can I look at that and go, that's all bad? No,
right.
I don't think it's all bad. Now they want their dog to be happy. And happy is not just chasing a ball. They really want joy emotionally. There ain't nothing wrong with that. On the other side, the problem, and based on one study, this is a survey study that was done in Hungary and Germany, okay? And so based on this study, what appeared to be true, first of all, is that the people surveyed in Germany and the people surveyed in Hungary were not homogenous. So they're just telling you there's biases, and there'd be biases in any country, okay? Mm-hmm. So they compared these two countries. And what they asked people were things like questions like, I have no problems with my dog at all. So you had the choice of disagree strongly, moderately disagree, neutral, moderately agree strongly. Like it's a Likert scale. So a Likert scale for people who don't follow science is where you usually get 5 choices. Sometimes you get 10, and it's on a scale from strongly disagreeing to neutral to strongly agreeing. So anyway, questions like that. Questions like, my dog thinks like a child. Okay, so now we're getting into the danger, right, of this kind of giving animals human traits. Because now there's an expectation that my dog can think like a child, which really isn't true. Okay, due to my dog, I feel that somebody loves me. Well, how could you? Of course. Yes, of course. But the problem with this thinking is what this particular research group found was that more empathetic owners were more likely to say that their dog yawns when they yawn. So they're saying, my dog reads me. My dog gets me. That's dangerous. I don't even know if my husband gets me, right? My dog gets me. These people that were more likely to say, hey, my dog is like a child, they were more likely to assume that when they had a certain feeling, their dog had that feeling. This is very dangerous because we are putting a lot of weight on the shoulders of these animals, and that is not fair, frankly.
You can find Dr. Radasta on Instagram at Dr. Lisa Radasta and at her website, drlisaradasta.com. And both have great resources for pet parents dealing with pets with behavior problems. We'll be right back. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's important to point that out that with this anthropomorphizing, you know, it's great if it gives us a connection to our animals, but we have to understand that we're also putting this pressure on them to live up to that other side of it. If we think they're capable of that, I want to bring this around. I could talk to you for a really long time about this. Like you said, this is a big topic, but let's hit one more thing that I think does a lot of harm to dogs when we project it on them. And that's manipulation. sort of adjacent to, oh, they're guilty because they know better. I get a lot of clients that say, oh, they're doing this to get the treat, or they're doing that so that they don't, you know, that basically boils down to thinking that the dog is manipulating them. Is that something that dogs are capable of?
Well, so again, here I go with taking the words and mashing them up into their little bits.
Set me straight.
No, it's just when, you know, so to manipulate is to move or change. Okay. So again, we are taking all of our human being emotional baggage and we're dumping it into this word. Labels are helpful and labels are harmful. So when I think of manipulate, I think of how I manipulate a hair tie to get my hair in a ponytail. It's just a thing that I do. I don't think that my hands are evil, and I don't think that they don't like my hair. And I don't think that I'm using the hair tie and throwing it away when I'm done. No, it's just a hair tie, right? So if I look at just the that definition of to manipulate, yes, dogs manipulate the environment, as do I, as do you. That does not imply that there's malice. So let's think about that. My dog, for example, let's say, you know, first of all, he doesn't have a job. He's not a working dog. He doesn't herd sheep all day. He doesn't go into a police truck and work all day with a police officer. He lies around all day. So what does he do? He's no dummy. Even though I joke that he's one beer short of a six pack, he's not a dummy. Okay. He watches me. What are you doing? Okay. Well, let's see. Every time she goes to the right of the stove, she makes a certain sound, and that sound is paired with the opening of my treat jar. I'll put those things together. I'll learn those things. Okay, right? So he's linking things together. So how might he learn to manipulate the environment to get what he wants? Well, let's say one day he, wants petting. And it comes up to my chair. My dog really only has one signal, and that's looking at me and panting. It's the only signal he's ever had. So we try to figure out what he wants. So as he's looking at me and panting, I'm like, okay, do you want to be petted? Do you want to go out? Do you want a cookie? So let's say one day I hand him a cookie and he goes, what? Is this real? She'll walk over to the treat jar and make the sound, and I'll get the treat, and I just panted. What happened? So then the next day he goes, well, I'm feeling hungry. I'm a lab. I'm always hungry. Let's give this a go. I'm just going to look at her and pant. Oh my God, she did it again. She walked right over there. This is crazy town, right? So why wouldn't he? What is immoral about him going, I like food. And if I do this, she gives me food. There's nothing wrong with that. Dogs manipulate their environment. They alter the environment, and they alter our behavior as best they can to get what they feel they need at that moment. And the example I gave is very non-emotional, although for my dog, food, I bet is emotional. I bet it's really emotional. But there's actually one study that tried to measure with infrared the emotions of dogs when they got really tasty treats. It's kind of cute, but
what was the infrared supposed to be reading?
Yeah. So what this study did was they had several different situations, right? And one situation was baseline. So they're measuring the dog's baseline, like, what are you like, measuring with the infrared? How aroused is the dog? They're also measuring heart rate and something called heart rate variability, which I can talk about in just a second. But so they measured baseline. They measure when they give the dog a super tasty treat, and they made sure that they knew that the treat was really tasty to start with. So all the dogs really wanted the treat that their pet parent had, and then after feeding. So what the infrared was supposed to do is measure emotional state, but it didn't measure emotional state because you can't do that. But it did measure arousal. So it was able to identify arousal. So neurochemical arousal is, epinephrine, norepinephrine, cortisol. It's a cascade of neurotransmitters and hormones, and it's blunt. It's a blunt instrument to change all of these processes in the body, like blood glucose goes up and blood shunted to the muscles. So One of the reasons why we can't say for sure if dogs have emotions, even though studies are trying to prove it, and I think it's indisputable, but whatever. One of the reasons we really can't prove it is because the emotion, the arousal response is it's blunt. And what I mean by that is I can't, researchers right now in human medicine, to my knowledge, and I'm 100% certain in dogs, we cannot separate out the neurochemistry of fear versus the neurochemistry of excitement versus frustration, right?
Really? In humans even?
This is what now, I'm not a neuroscientist for human beings. So, but that's my understanding of what I have read most recently is that we can't know. There's
it's just arousal. Research.
It's arousal.
We can't
right.
And certain, wow.
Right. And certain things do increase. Like there's studies looking at when people hug their dog or pet their dog, oxytocin increases. But, and we grab onto that and that goes into the popular media and it's really exciting. But what we have to do is go, okay, is the reverse true? When oxytocin increases, I'm always feeling love, because that is how the lay public reads that. Mm-hmm. If we say when we pet our dog, our blood pressure goes down and oxytocin increases, that does not mean the reverse is true. That every time oxytocin increases, I am feeling love. Do you see? And that's not science. That's not how it works. So when I say we can't absolutely identify, it's because we can't say the reverse is true. And I've been talking to a researcher at Arizona. His name is Dr. McLean. And if you guys want to read some cool work, Evan McLean, he's McLean. He's the dude. And he has done so much work on vasopressin and oxytocin in dogs. Like, to me, at least, I love reading research on Sunday mornings with my coffee. And what he does is very exciting. Trying to measure, like, okay, what can we measure that will give us an idea of acute stress in dogs versus chronic stress? If oxytocin goes up, does that mean love? Because it can mean stress. So this is where we have to be careful. We see certain things go up and we say the body has mounted a stress response, but we cannot say for sure what the dog's emotional state is. And I say that knowing full well that every day in my clinic, I talk to people about the emotional state of their dog based on their dog's body language and arousal. I do every day. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're pairing the fact that they are aroused, which we can measure, with body language cues that help us narrow down, hopefully, which state they're in.
Yeah.
Stressed or happy. We're over time, of course.
Oh, no.
That's all right. That's all right. I do just want to circle back, because in case people sort of, just for the takeaway of like, do dogs feel guilt?
No.
We think no. They're responding, that body language, they're responding to your actions and trying to appease or submit or fawn so that you won't, I don't want to say hurt them. I don't want to believe anyone who listens to this podcast would hurt their dog intentionally, but that's their thought. It's like, don't hurt me. I don't know why you're mad, but.
Yes. But I tell my clients, don't act like a fool, because when you yell at your dog and you act like a fool, your dog doesn't know what you're doing and you're stressing your dog out.
Yeah.
And when your dog is stressed out, then your dog says, hey man, I don't know what's wrong with you, but I do not want to fight you on this.
Yeah.
So let's just simplify it. Those deferential signals are whatever you're upset about. I swear I was not a part of this. I do not want to upset you. The dog's not saying, oh, I peed on the couch, so screw you. And now I feel guilty. No, he's saying, Dude, you're acting out. Are you okay? I swear I wasn't a part of whatever you're upset about. Must have been the cat. Must have been somebody else.
Oh, the poor cat.
Right? Yeah.
And then do dogs manipulate us?
Dogs change the environment and train us to get what they need. And I don't blame them. And that doesn't have any moral context. Dogs have no agency, people. They have no control over their lives. That's why, and I know we're over, but I just got to say this, and maybe you'll edit me out, or maybe this will be two podcasts. But so I tell people, they're like, well, my dog thinks he's the leader. And I'm like, what world are you in? Your yeah. dog doesn't even have the power to go to the bathroom when he wants. He doesn't even have the power to walk into the pantry and get a snack, unless it's my lab who goes in the pantry and eats power bars and then throws up the wrappers. But like, you know, think of that. Think yeah. of that. What if you didn't have the agency to take care of your basic needs? Might you manipulate the environment and the other beings in the environment in order to serve your needs? I would 100% do that. And I do that. You know yeah. how many animals I've brought home to my house, right? So I've manipulated my husband's environment. Mm-hmm. And then approach the situation in such a way, the day I brought home a horse, that was a big one. Approach the situation in such a way to manipulate my husband's answer so that the horse would stay without conflict between my husband and I. We do this every day. Come on.
Somebody had a post that I think just phrased it really well, is that manipulating the environment is the function of behavior.
Exactly.
It's working. So yeah, they do manipulate. Exactly. We all do it. That's how behavior works.
Yeah.
That's why we behave, to yeah. get a response.
Totally.
The end.
Yeah.
So let's end on that. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
That's a wrap on season 3. I'll be back with season 4 in 2024. I want to thank each and every one of you for joining me at the dojo all season long. I've been humbled and amazed at how many people are listening. I hope you find listening as enjoyable as I find making the show. You can help more people find the podcast by sharing it with your friends, subscribing wherever you listen, and rating it. These things really make a difference, so thank you for taking the time. This is your aspiring sensei, Susan, signing off for now. You can find me at www.doggydojopodcast.com, or I'm Susan Light LA on Instagram, Pinterest, and Facebook. The music was written by Mac Light. You can find him at maclightsongwriter.com. Just a legal disclaimer, this podcast is intended for educational purposes only and does not constitute advice or professional services by either the host nor any of the guests. Thank you.